So, good morning. Welcome to another lecture on gravitational waves. So the last time we talked about the energy in gravitational waves and the energy loss formula. And we will close this chapter today, or this section, and then we'll continue and talk about the field theoretical approach to gravitational waves. And we'll introduce also the concept of gravitons. Probably we have been missing gravitons since the start of this lecture, so now they will come, gravitons, finally. Any questions about last lecture before we start?
Could you maybe within 3 minutes recap the second half?
So no. No. I was just asked to recap the second half of the whole lecture. I will recap.
Just the topic.
Yeah. No, don't worry. Yeah. So we were looking at gravitational wave energies, continued, and we were looking at the following formula, that we had a covariant derivative of the energy momentum tensor, which was split in two parts, and only both of them were zero, right? So d bar mu was the covariant derivative with respect to the average or the low frequency background, with respect to G bar mu nu. Yeah, background. I write it in brackets. The background metric. You recall that we split the metric into two parts, a background metric, G bar basically, plus a high frequency part from the gravitational waves. So in T bar mu nu was then given by basically the average on that background. Yeah. Average on a scale capital L, which was in between the scale of the background and the scale of gravitational waves. Yeah. So this could be a spatial, or it could be also a temporal average, actually, so in time. Average. Now, either you assume I have a box and average over that box, or you say I count many periods of frequencies, for example, and then I get this expression. Basically, the high frequency part cancels out. Okay? And then the small t mu nu is basically the part from the gravitational waves. They are hidden in there. Yeah. And they were constructed by looking at the second correction factor. So we did an expansion in the Ricci tensor, and then we had a zero part, which was the background. The first part, which was then just the high frequency mode, and then we had a higher order, which had mixed parts, low and high frequencies. And that's the one which enters actually here. So at second order, we have then components here. Okay, and only both of them are conserved. This means also that if we have some source of gravitational wave, which is of course hidden in the background somehow, that energy goes into gravitational waves. So there's total energy is conserved, but only that far that the energy carried by gravitational waves is extracted from the background or from the matter. Okay, that's how to read that equation. So, and then we can recast that equation. At the end of the lecture, we found that the energy loss dE over dt, yeah, which came from looking at the zero component of small t, was then given by C cubed R squared over 32 pi g, and then some average over the steradiant, the average over our spatial-temporal region, hij in the tt gauge, h dot ij in the tt gauge. Yeah, that's what we had at the end of the lecture. Good.
Is that an R squared?
That is supposed to be an R squared. This comes from the integration over the volume, basically, here. Integration. Right, this is what we had derived in detail, right? Okay, good. Good. Okay. Maybe in between to make it clear. So what we used was that dE over dt over dA, where A is basically the surface around our spatial temperature average, was just minus C times T 0, 0. Yeah? And then dA is just R squared d omega, and then we got this equation here. Okay, so of course we can recast that. We can use the Fourier transform, and then this would be the amplitude of the plus polarization squared plus the amplitude of the cross polarization squared, and so on and so on. I will spare you those details because you want to go on in the lectures. What I want to write down in addition is actually that we also transfer momentum with the gravitation wave, not only energy, which is clear from the energy momentum relation we have also for gravitation waves, which is the same as for light. So we have also a flux, energy flux. Yeah, let's call it energy flux. An energy flux, or you can also call it then momentum. This is just by looking at the k component. So we define dpk over dt dA as a t 0 k. And then one finds that dpk over dt is equal minus c cubed over 32 pi g, also times r squared, integral over just the radiant, now from the average of hij tt dot. And the other one, of course, has to be a derivative with respect to spatial components. Yeah, so this is a dk hij, again, in the tt gauge. Good. Any questions? Good. Yeah, we already showed that we have this gauge invariance of this one expression we started with that we did in the exercise yesterday. So we can really use H in the TT gauge. Yeah, so. Good. So the last subsection is propagation in curved space-time. Yeah, all the time we were talking about that we have some curved background, G bar mu nu, not a flat background. So we consider basically the generic case that a gravitation wave is traveling through any space-time we have. So now you can imagine you have, for example, a supermassive black hole. And a gravitational wave is coming along and it's going towards the black hole. What is happening? Stuff like that. Yeah. So let's see what comes out. So we were looking at the high mode equation, High mode means large frequency. So we had R mu nu of 1 is equal. This was purely high mode, and then we project out from the second order just the high modes. High modes plus 8 pi g over c to the fourth power, and then comes the component from matter, t mu nu minus a half g mu nu times t, 2, and this is again the high mode. Okay, and then we do an expansion in our scales. So we say that we're looking at the order of the amplitude h. H is supposed to be a small amplitude. And we discussed before that basically this is related to the frequency at hand over the scale of the curvature of the background. Yeah, this was the frequency of the gravitation wave, small one. This is the curvature scale of the background, large one. And this we can call epsilon parameter, where we do the expansion with. Okay. So now generically we know that the Ricci tensor is a second derivative. Yeah. So if we just consider the high modes for this one, this has to be proportional to the derivative squared of the amplitude h. And as we are working to first order in h, we have the second derivative, but h only at first order. Yeah. So this is proportional to, now here we have the derivative, so this goes like 1 over lambda squared, basically, the scale of the frequency, the scale of the wave. So this is proportional to h over lambda bar squared. Okay, that's the first one. Now the second one is that we have R mu nu to second order. Yeah, this is proportional again to the second derivative. But now this is second order, so this goes like h squared. Yeah. So this is proportional to h squared over lambda bar squared. Okay, so this would be of higher order. So in vacuum, so if we choose t mu nu equals 0, then it follows automatically. This is higher order, this is 0, this has to be 0. So r mu nu 1 is equal to 0, and from that it follows just the standard wave equation, D'Alembert operator of the traceless part of the tensor responsible for gravitational waves is 0. Okay, fine. Good. So two order h over lambda bar squared. So we have here the gravitational wave equation. Fine, good, works, check. So now we do introduce matter into that equation. Okay. So let's see what comes out. So expansion in epsilon. In epsilon. Now we assume that h is much, much smaller than lambda bar over L bar. Is much, much smaller than 1 in matter. So if we look at the expression we have for t mu nu minus a half g mu nu times t, the high part must be then of order h over the curvature of the background squared. And that's the only scale which can enter basically for for the background. So now, but now, our menu of 1 was considered to be of order h over lambda squared. This is larger than this term, as lambda bar over L is much smaller than 1, by assumption. Yeah, so this is heavily suppressed, basically. So therefore, it follows that we have, again, R mu nu of 1 is equal 0. Yeah. And from this, it follows now that the covariant derivative of H mu nu bar is equal 0. Yeah. And also that now the covariant derivative d bar d rho h bar mu nu is equal 0. Yeah. So we have the same equation, but now we have this background metric g bar mu nu instead. And instead of this D'Alembert operator, we just have to replace it with the covariant derivative with respect to the curved background. So basically, the propagation of the gravitation waves follows the same pattern, but now onto this curved background. So the conclusions we have is gravitons travel along geodesics. In the curved background, G bar mu nu. Oh, let's write it like this. That's the central conclusion of this one. Yeah? So this means they behave exactly as photons. So you know when photons travel in Schwarzschild metric around a black hole or around the sun, the path is just bent because they follow just the geodesics in curved space-time. Exactly the same is happening here. So if gravitational waves come toward a black hole, they do the same as photons, exactly the same. This is what this equation tells us. So they are also curved around the black hole, so gravitational waves can be focused by the black hole. So we have a gravitational lens which is not only acting on photons, but it's also acting on gravitational waves. So behave as photons in curved space-time. So there will be a deflection, and there will also be a redshift. So if you have a gravitational wave, if you have a tower, and instead of emitting a laser light, we would emit a laser gravitational wave with a certain frequency. If we can do this, we would measure a redshift of that gravitational wave. So deflection, redshift is happening, like for photons. We can also consider scattering. So when you're imagining that a photon is hitting a black hole, you can also consider scattering processes, and you can say, okay, the probability that a scattering is happening on the black hole is of course proportional somehow to the surface area we are looking at. So we have a flux of incoming photons, and the probability to hit that one is proportional to the area of the black hole. That's for photons, and the same would be the case then for gravitons. So you can consider, if you say photons also can be considered as particles, and gravitational wave can be considered as gravitons, as particles, you can consider even a cross-section for scattering. Yeah. Yeah, the scattering then, the mean free path, you can define a mean free path. Mean free path L is then 1 over the number density times sigma, where N is the number density. Where the gravitational wave is scattered to, so this would be the mass density, and sigma is the cross section. The cross section, which means this is just the probability that a collision is happening, which goes like 1 over the area. So the dimension is proportional to 1 over the area of the scattering. So if you count this, this is 1 over the volume. Of course, it is proportional to the area. It's 1 over the volume times the area, so this is 1 over a length scale, so then it has the right dimension. Yeah. And the cross-section we can then approximate as the following. On a nucleus, it has to go like the coupling constant squared, so this is the gravitational coupling constant squared, which enters here. And the energy scale, if we scatter on nucleons, is the mass of the nucleon on nucleons. So this would be the scattering process on nucleons if we have gravitational waves. And of course, this is heavily suppressed. Yeah? This g goes like 1 over the Planck scale squared, so this goes like 1 over the Planck scale to the 4th power. So this is heavily suppressed, for example, to the electromagnetic cross-section, which goes like 1 over, or if you look at weak interactions go like 1 over the Higgs boson mass squared, basically, which is 100 GeV, compared to 10 to 19 GeV for the Planck scale, and you square that, so this is suppressed by 17 orders of magnitude squared, 34 orders of magnitude. So this is really teeny-weeny, not only tiny, but really teeny-weeny cross-section. Tiny squared, tiny, tiny. Tiny, tiny. Okay, questions?
Yeah. The last two lines on the right, or the last three lines, how do we get from R mu order, first order is of order h over lambda bar squared, how do we get from there to R first order is zero?
Which line are you?
The third from the bottom.
1, 2, 3. This one?
This one and the first equation. How do we get from there to the first equation in the line below?
This one?
Yes. How do we get from...
Oh, we just look at the terms we have. So we look at this whole expression we have. We did this expansion and then figured this is the first order part is only the high frequency part, contains only the amplitude h, basically, nothing else. Then if you go to second order, we have mixed terms. We have high frequencies and low frequencies. So we project out for this part the high frequency part of this one plus the matter contribution. Now, I just argued that this term is always higher order in H, so this is suppressed. So we can ignore this. If we include matter, I just argued that this part here is also suppressed because it goes like 1 over the length scale of the background squared, which is much smaller than this part, which goes like 1 over lambda bar squared. Yeah, which is smaller, so this is larger. So we can set those two terms to zero, also this one, and then R mu nu at two first orders just zero again.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then we do the usual analysis. We find we have then a wave equation, but now the derivative is with respect to the background, which is curved by matter.
Yeah? So does it mean that gravitons travel along null geodesics, as photons do?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. They travel along null geodesics. Yeah, these are geodesics, null curves.
But they are the space-time itself that is curved, so how do you define a null geodesic then? If you because they change the space-time itself.
Oh yeah, you ignore this, of course. You say this is higher order, so mm-hmm. that the gravitons curve the background itself is higher order. So this is ignored. This is how we do this expansion. The same, it's the same for photons. You can also argue if the photons travel through Schwarzschild metric, you don't consider that the photon carries energy and gravity couples to energy. So this energetic particle would spoil somehow the Schwarzschild metric. It's ignored, so it's a test particle. And the same is happening here, but you have to be, of course, more careful and consider it, that there are back reactions possible, and that's why we do this expansion. But it turns out there the back reaction is negligible, or of higher order, so to say.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, so we close this chapter. This was a geometric approach to gravitational waves. And in the next chapter, we are talking about the field theoretical approach to gravitational waves. Yeah, so basically, we're doing now really classical field theory. And consider we have now a classical field, which is, of course, again, the H mu nu. And we have an action. But now we somehow expand on flat background. So classical field theory, of course, is only defined on some flat background. And then we have to do a different expansion and a different treatment. And we're looking at Lagrangians and energy momentum conservation we get from the field itself, and so on and so on. And thereby, of course, we can also introduce all the nice concepts which have been developed for classical field theory in general, which are also the basis for quantum field theory, actually. Yeah, and of course, one hope was to quantize this classical field theory of gravitons to get a theory of quantum gravity. But you will see shortly that there are inherent difficulties to quantize that theory. So we consider now gravitational waves as a classical field theory. And we are back, actually, in this case, to linearized gravity. We're working on flat space-time and do an expansion thereof. So G mu nu is equal eta mu nu plus H mu nu. Yeah. So where H mu nu is now a classical field. In flat space-time. And it turns out this is a complementary viewpoint. We come to the same formulas we have derived actually as in a geometric approach, as it should be, of course. So So linearized gravity as a classical field theory. So, before we start, we have to recapitulate some basics of classical field theory. So we consider fields phi I in flat space-time. And with the action which is written down in the next part of the blackboard. So we have an action, capital S, which is an integral over time, over volume, d3x. And then we have a Lagrangian density, phi I, d phi I. Having said Lagrangian, Lagrange was Italian, so he was born in Turin, actually, and then moved later on to France. So he's not French, so it's not Lagrange. I always said Lagrange, but it's actually Lagrange. And if you go to Turin, there's a Via Lagrange also. And you see then there's a monument for in honor of the great son of Turin. So it's Lagrange. So it's not that I'm able to speak properly French, it's really Lagrange. So let's do a transformation of coordinates. Who has been listening to classical field theory before? Who knows how to derive the energy momentum tensor for classical field theory in general? But you can derive the equation of motion of a classical field theory that you have done maybe in electrodynamics, also for a classical field.
You mean with Euler-Lagrange equations? For
yes, animals? Yes, okay.
Seen that before? Seen that before?
Yes, yes. You can also do the same. It's basically the same you can do then in classical Hamiltonian or Lagrange formalism for mechanics. You transpose this to classical fields. So instead of talking about a Lagrange function, we have a Lagrange density. That's why we have this curly L over there. It has a different dimension than the usual capital L. So the transformation of coordinates. Who has ever been looking into the book of Landau on mechanics, the first booklet? How it starts with mechanics. It starts with a Lagrange function and explaining how you get from the invariance under transformation in time, energy conservation, and invariance, momentum conservation under invariance of basically a transformation in space. That's how this booklet starts. So it's very nice to read, actually. You should read it, yeah. Of course, if you have learned mechanics somehow in a different way before, then reading Landau is really a pleasure. So, but can you imagine a first semester starting with the first page, we have this Lagrange function, then we do, okay. Yeah, old Russian school. Transformation of coordinates, so we have an x mu goes to an x mu prime, and the fields, phi of x, basically change to different fields, phi prime, within a new coordinates, x prime. So now we have an infinitesimal transformation, So x mu goes to x prime mu, which is equal x mu plus an epsilon parameter times another function which depends on x, which has an index mu. Yeah. And now we can consider, as we generalize that, it could be that it is just one function. That's what we had for gr, we had just this xi. Yeah. But there could be different functions, and they have an additional label. Yeah. So what you can do here is actually you can introduce here some group structure. And that's how you have then a more general transformation law by choosing index A. And the same we're doing for phi of x goes to phi prime of x prime is equal to phi of x. Let's put this index I in here, plus the same epsilon and some other functions, fi, a, which depend on phi and the first derivatives of phi. Yeah? Only the ordinary field enters and the derivative enters. This is how we set up the Lagrange function, actually. Yeah? There are no higher order derivatives. It's only a function of the up to first order derivatives. So now we have symmetry transformations. If the action is invariant, if action S of phi is invariant. In general, it's a functional.
Yeah, because you wrote S of phi is invariant, like it's a function. So,
what did I write?
In the last line, you wrote S of phi, and normally with a functional, you have different types of brackets. So.
Oh, okay. You want to have these brackets here?
Yeah, exactly. So, just
possibly, yes, yes.
Suddenly a function because we're in some other kind of thing.
So one can distinguish between the symmetry transformation two types. So for any field phi, we can have either a global symmetry transformation, which would mean that we have the case that epsilon A is a constant. So in every space-time point, we have the same small parameter in our transformation, and the action is invariant. Or we have a local symmetry for epsilon A is equal epsilon A of x. Yeah, so this epsilon parameter depends on space-time, and we have a local symmetry. This is how one introduces actually the concept then of gauge fields. So you have a global symmetry, and then now you invoke that is epsilon is basically a new degree of freedom, which depends on space-time, which will become your gauge field. But this just as a side remark. So now we have to invoke Noether's theorem. Noether's theorem, which you all know. So for each epsilon A, which is then a generator of a symmetry, generator of a global symmetry, there is a current which is conserved. There is a conserved current. J mu A. On the classical level. So which means that d mu, where phi is a classical field, is equal to zero. There are quantum anomalies where this is not zero anymore, but we're not discussing this. And correspondingly, there are conserved charges. With conserved charges, where QA is just the integral of d3x of the zero component of that current, which depends on x and t. Yeah, well, I should be maybe more specific here. Okay. Yeah, let's quickly look at this conserved current. So we have the time derivative of this conserved quantity is equal to integral d3x of the time derivative of the zero component of this current, which depends on t and x. And this is from this equation here, from the conservation, is just minus the integral d3x spatial derivative of the spatial component of that current, which then is equal to zero. Now basically we can recast this in a boundary term using Stokes' theorem, and then we just say at the boundary this is vanishing. For sufficiently fast vanishing fields, at infinity. At infinity. Okay. Questions? That you have seen before, I guess. Good. So explicitly, one can construct this current, this conserved current, out of this global symmetry transformation. So one makes this global symmetry transformation, then demands that the action has to be invariant. And that gives a condition on a quantity which is going to fulfill that equation. So explicitly one can compute this current. So we have J mu A is given by the partial derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the derivative of the fields. And then we have the function A nu A of x d nu phi I minus f I minus A mu A of x times the Lagrangian itself. Okay. Maybe we can do this in the exercise, how to derive this conserved current. So once you have the Lagrangian, and once you say, okay, I have this global symmetry so that there shall be invariant under these transformations, then the conserved current can be computed like that from the Lagrangian, pretty generic. So application, let's make an example. Space-time translations. And as said before, when we do the space-time relations, we're coming just to energy and momentum conservation. So we are saying that x mu prime is equal x mu plus epsilon mu. And we just consider there is no change in the fields. Yeah, that's it. So we can recast this in the above form by saying that this is x mu plus an epsilon nu and the Kronecker delta mu nu. Yeah. So we can read off that this function delta mu is just this Kronecker delta. Where is this comma coming from here? Okay, this is confusing. Okay. And the index A is now basically the index nu, which is going over our four-dimensional space-time. Okay? So we have a symmetry onto space-time, basically, here, which we're considering. So, okay, so we can say that A mu nu is equal delta mu nu. And F is 0. FIA is equal to 0. That's what we are reading off from the transformation of the fields. So now we have two indices. We have a current and we have the index nu. So it turns out this has to be a tensor. Yeah, so we have four conserved currents for each index mu. As we have a delta mu, and the index is nu. Yeah, so we have this for each index, we have this conserved current, which is just, and now this is by definition, there comes a minus sign in, but never mind. This is just a current. So what one finds that actually this is the energy momentum tensor is theta mu nu. So we have a theta mu nu is then equal minus this one. This stays as it is, dl over d over d mu phi I. Okay. Then this is the Kronecker delta. So this gives just the d mu phi. D mu phi I. And upper index, yes, this is correct. Plus, this is 0. And here we get again a Kronecker delta times the Lagrange function. So this is just taking the Kronecker delta down with the other index. We're working in flat space-time, so this is just eta mu nu times the Lagrangian. Yeah, and then this is a conserved current. And this is exactly the expression in classical field theory for the energy momentum tensor, so this gives energy momentum conservation. Who has seen this energy momentum tensor before? Two.
For gravitational waves.
No, this. I mean, this is not for gravitational waves so far. So we're doing really a general discussion of classical field theory. Gravitational waves will come shortly. No, I mean for classical field theory. Have you seen this before? A few ones. Yeah. Okay. So, okay. Just two small remarks, then I will stop for a break. So I said before, the conserved charges are just energy momentum. Yeah, they're not really charges, so they're really four momenta. So the four momentum P nu. So the energy is C times P zero, and this is defined as the integral d3x of theta 0, 0, and then we have a C pi is then just given by the integral d3x over theta 0 I. Yeah? Good. Any questions so far? Okay, if not, we make a small break and reconvene in 5 minutes. So, here we go. Okay. So, let's continue. We were talking about the energy momentum tensor. However, the energy momentum tensor, as it is written down, is not unique. Not unique. So one can add actually a total for the divergence. So L prime is L plus a total a derivative of a vector function k. Then the integral over d4x gives just a boundary term. Not by Stokes' theorem, just a boundary term. A boundary in space-time. And the equation of motion so if we vary the field varying phi by keeping fixed the boundary, this is how you do it. Basically you have these two endpoints fixed and you vary the function in between, so you're not changing the boundary. By keeping fixed the boundary, no change to the equations of motion. However, the neutral currents can be different. So, however, so the neutral currents can be different. For L and L prime. In this case, it is that the zero component of this current changes by a total spatial divergence, so a boundary term. Thank you. and the charge Q, the conserved charge, by a boundary term. Okay. How can we resolve this? So we have, of course, be really sure that we have fields that go to zero at a boundary sufficiently fast. Only well defined. On volume V. If the fields go to zero at boundaries. Of V sufficiently fast. Okay, let's make an example. Let's look at electrodynamics. So we have the Lagrange function of electromagnetism, which is just minus 1/4 of F mu nu times F mu nu. Yeah. Where I should define F mu nu. F mu nu, put it down in the lower index, is d mu a nu minus d nu a nu. Yeah? Good. So with that Lagrange and with the usual recipe, we can compute now the energy momentum tensor. That we will do in the exercises for sure. But I guess you have probably seen this before. So this is dL over d mu a rho times d nu a rho. Be careful that you always choose different indices. This goes with the lower index. This also should go with the lower index. Plus eta mu nu times the electromagnetic Lagrangian. Okay? Yeah. If one does this properly, one finds that this is just F mu rho partial derivative d nu of a rho. Minus 1/4 over times eta mu nu times F squared. Yeah, being F, let's write it down, F mu nu, not to confuse you, times F squared in this form. Okay? Yeah, looks nice, doesn't it? So it's fairly easy to derive these expressions. However, you might wonder about this term here, because in addition to F mu nu, there appears now the derivative of this vector field itself, not the energy, the stress, the tensor of electromagnetic fields. Now, as this appears alone, this is not gauge invariant. Recall that if you have a gauge transformation in electromagnetism, you change A mu, gauge transformation goes as follows. So we have an A mu, which goes to A mu plus a partial derivative of some scalar field chi, which now is space-time dependent. So if you do this and plug this in into F mu nu, this of course will vanish because they're just derivatives, double derivatives, where you change the order of the derivatives and then they just cancel out. Yeah. But they do not cancel out here. So this expression is gauge dependent. So therefore, this is ill-defined. Oops. Okay. So what we're going to do? Exactly, we follow the recipe above. We change the Lagrangian by the total derivative, so to make the whole thing gauge invariant, or to project out the gauge invariant part and then have a boundary term left. If one does this gauge transformation, just to be clear, so theta mu nu electromagnetism changes to theta mu nu electromagnetism minus a term which goes like F mu rho d nu d rho chi. So it depends on chi. So let's rewrite theta mu nu. So theta mu nu, let's write it so that we only have f's basically there and something in addition, which you put to the side. So this is f mu rho times d nu a rho. And to make this also f mu nu type, we just do minus d rho a nu. And then add it so that this term cancels out. Yeah, so it's just rewritten plus the other term, minus 1 over 4 eta mu nu f squared. Okay, so this is equal f mu rho f nu rho minus 1 over 4 eta mu nu times the Lagrangian, times, which I write down, sorry, which is f squared, plus a remaining term, f mu rho d rho a nu. Okay? So we keep this term, and this term we can rewrite. We can rewrite it as a total derivative, d rho of f mu rho a nu. Because we can do this as the derivative d mu f mu nu is equal to 0 in any case, even if we do a gauge transformation, right? So we have. So we can rewrite this as a total derivative. So we have one term, which is the ordinary gauge invariant energy momentum tensor of electromagnetism, plus a term which depends on the boundary d rho, which we just write as a tensor of third order, rho mu nu. Now, and the important issue is now that C rho mu nu is antisymmetric. In the indices rho and mu. Now this comes here from the F tensor here, which is antisymmetric. Okay. Good. So now we really get that T00 is just a half times the electric field squared plus the magnetic field squared. So check. So this is fine, this is okay. And it's gauge invariant. So some nodes are in order. Nodes. So the first one is that if this total theta mu electromagnetism is equal to zero, then it follows that also this partial derivative of T mu is equal to zero, as the partial derivative now here of this remaining term is zero. Yeah. So we do the partial derivative of this expression. We get a partial derivative of this one plus the partial derivative of this one. Yeah. Now this partial derivative, you see, is a partial derivative in the indices mu and rho. Now this tensor is antisymmetric in mu and rho. So if we flip those derivatives and flip those ones, we get a minus sign. So then this expression is equal to minus the same expression, so the whole expression has to be zero. So this is zero, and this means that from this condition automatically it follows that we have energy momentum conservation just for the gauge invariant part, as it should be. Yeah? So the boundary term does not spoil energy momentum conservation here. So the difference between charges is now another issue. So we have an integral over a specific volume, d3x, d rho c, rho zero nu, is equal integral d3x over the volume of spatial derivative ci 0 nu. Yeah, and this follows as c 0 nu is equal to 0. Yeah, it's antisymmetric. C is antisymmetric in the first two indices, so we can't have the same indices. This component is zero. Okay. So we have an integral over a spatial divergence, integral of divergence. And this vanishes if fields at the boundary go sufficiently fast to zero. So to recap, so this total four dimensions divergence we can add to the Lagrangian gives this additional term here, which is partial derivative, antisymmetric in rho and mu. So that basically does not spoil this energy momentum conservation. And it only spoils the conserved charges if we have some impact on the boundary. So we can rewrite this as a boundary term, and if at the boundary of this certain volume, the fields go sufficiently fast to zero, then also it will not affect the conserved charges. Yeah? So again, we come to the point that we have to do some averaging, actually, to get rid of this artifact for the conserved charges. Yeah? So the resolution is the following. So hence, compute average. Value of theta mu nu over large volume. So that all boundary terms vanish. Yeah, so we have an averaging over our electromagnetic energy momentum tensor, which is a gauge invariant part and a part which depends on this tensor CI00, so that this basically is just the average over the electromagnet energy momentum tensor. Yeah, and then everything is unambiguously defined. So there are two issues. One issue is the fields have to go sufficiently fast to zero, and we have to do this averaging. You see that we can only argue that this is zero if we have some integral we were talking about. So again, we need this averaging over volume. We have seen this before in a geometric approach, so it appears again here in the classical field theory, now from a different perspective. Yeah, but we come again to the same conclusion. We have to look at averages, spatial averages, in space to get rid of artifacts in a classical field theory. In the same pattern we have seen in a geometric approach. Okay, questions so far?
Yes, so when we changed our Lagrangian by adding this for divergence, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't specify how this for divergence exactly looks. Right, so this, we added this divergence of k mu of phi. So what exactly, or in a physical meaning, what is this k mu of phi? So we didn't actually compute it. That was just the reasoning why we could change the current, the conserved current theta, right?
Yeah. So the question was, how is the specific form of this four divergence we add to the Lagrangian? And in this case, actually, we add another term where we add this d nu, a mu, actually, in different forms. We had plus and minus. So this is what we add here to theta mu nu. So we specified it here in such a way that you get some gauge invariant quantity. But it could be pretty generic. It could be some different function. It was just a generic function to make the argument that we get boundary terms which actually change not only the Lagrangian, but also the energy momentum tensor. So you can recast basically the term, the additional term we introduced, you can basically recast that we add actually a term to the Lagrangian to get the true gauge invariant quantity. So that's what you can also do. You can change the Lagrangian in such a way that you always come up with the gauge invariant expression automatically.
Yeah, because I thought that's what we do, that we change the Lagrangian. So could we actually write down the new Lagrangian, the L prime? How would it look?
Oh, that's a good question, yeah. That might be a nice exercise, yeah. So the question was, how is the specific form of this d mu k mu look like if we add it to the Lagrangian that we get automatically a gauge invariant quantity? Yeah. Very nice exercise, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer yet. I have to sit down by myself and check it. So, okay, any other question? If you look at the energy momentum tensor, which appear actually in the equation of motion of Einstein, or in the Einstein field equation, there always appears also a T mu nu on the right-hand side. Now you might wonder that maybe that expression is not gauge invariant. But it turns out the way this energy momentum tensor is defined in GR is in fact defined in a different way such that it's automatically gauge invariant and we don't have these difficulties. So these difficulties arise because you assume that this Lagrangian depends on the field phi and d mu of phi and then do this derivation like this with the Noether currents. But a more general approach is, does anybody know how the energy momentum tensor is defined in general relativity? For the Einstein field equations, how you get this T mu nu from a Hilbert action, from a Lagrangian.
It's this Einstein-Hilbert action.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody knows how the T mu nu is defined there? It's not defined the way we do it here, that we vary the fields. But similarly, so what you actually do is that you say you do a variation of the action with respect to the full metric G mu nu. And then the variation of the meta Lagrangian, just the meta part under G mu nu, gives you the energy momentum tensor. So the energy momentum tensor is defined as the variation with regard to space-time, G mu nu. And then if you would do classical field theory, so you would add a classical field theoretical Lagrangian to the Einstein-Hilbert action and then do the variation with respect to the metric, you get automatically the correct expression even for electromagnetism. Which is nice. Okay, good. Okay. Has anybody been doing Einstein-Hilbert action and variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action to get the equation for general relativity? We briefly discussed this in the first lecture, but maybe you ignored this or forgot. Or okay. Good. Okay, so here we go. Now we can compute the energy momentum tensor of gravitational waves directly. So again, we have a wave packet. With a characteristic length lambda bar averaged over a box. That's what we have to do to get rid of this term. Averaged over a box of size L, which is much larger than the scale from the gravitational wave. So we can average also over many periods of the gravitational wave. Then we can ignore boundary terms. This is actually an additional assumption. So basically, what we assume that asymptotically we are flat. So the Schwarzschild metric, for example, is asymptotically flat. Yeah, so we can ignore boundary terms. And then the energy momentum tensor T mu nu is given by the average over minus the Lagrangian over d d mu h alpha beta d nu h alpha beta upper, this is wrong, this should be lower index, plus eta mu nu times d Lacossian. Right? I basically recast the expression we had before, and instead of the field phi, I put in now h alpha beta. And to get rid of the boundary terms, we have this averaging here. That's it. Yeah. So this is what classical field theory tells us. So this is the spatial average. Double dots, spatial average. Over several lambdas. Okay, so now we need L. Okay, we have some time to get L. And I need more space. So need L. So we expand the Einstein action. Action to order h squared. Okay, so we have the full Einstein action. And we have written this down before. The full Einstein action is just S Einstein is C cubed over 16 pi G. Integral over four-dimensional space-time with the proper Jacobian, square root of minus g. This is just the Jacobian from any space-time transformation, square root of minus g, where g is the determinant of g mu nu. We had this before, I'm pretty sure. Times the Ricci scalar. That's it. From this equation, you can derive the equation in vacuum of Einstein. So now we expand g mu nu so we have flat space-time plus a small perturbation, and one finds the following, that the Ricci scalar is defined as the contraction of the Ricci tensor, and this is like eta mu nu plus h mu nu plus higher orders in h squared times r mu nu to first order plus r mu nu to second order. This is supposed to be a 1 plus higher order terms of h cubed. Yeah, so this one is of order h, And this one is of order h squared, as we did before, actually. So we need also to expand, actually, the square root of minus g.
Is it a cross product or is it just normal multiplication?
This is just a multiplication. So g mu nu is equal delta mu nu plus an h mu nu. And this we can define as basically some matrix, which is basically just a one matrix, and the other matrix h, which is the one responsible for gravitational waves. So the determinant of g mu nu can be written as the determinant of eta mu rho in our approximation. Yeah. So this is g rho nu. And this is equal minus 1. The determinant of a times b is determinant of a times determinant of b. Yeah, so this is minus 1 times the determinant of g rho nu. And then this is equal minus the determinant of I plus h. Okay, now we use the usual trick. So we use that log of the determinant of A is equal to the trace of the log of A. And then we find the following for the determinant of I plus H. So this is the exponential of log times the determinant of I plus h. This is a curly bracket. Okay. Then this is equal the exponential of, so log that we rewrite as trace log. So this is the trace log, that is the trace of log h, log of I plus h, curly brackets. And this we can rewrite as the exponential of the trace of h plus order h squared. So we can expand this one, this expression here, this logarithm formally. So this is basically a 1 plus a small correction h. Log of 1 plus x is approximately x plus x squared plus x cubed and so on. So this gives just h plus h squared and so on. We can ignore the higher order term. So this is just exponential of the trace of h. So we can expand this one here. So this is actually then a 1 plus the trace of h. Yeah, so we do an expansion of e of x. E of x is 1 plus x and so on, if x is small compared to 1. So this is 1 plus trace h plus higher order terms in h squared. Okay? The one missing in the H, where?
Here?
Yeah. No, there's no one. Just recall that log 1 plus x is about x, x plus higher orders of x squared. Trace of capital H is, of course, just small h, the usual trace of H menu, plus higher orders in H squared, or in H menu, whatever. Yeah, so here, H is just a trace of H, which is just H mu, mu. Good, so let's put everything together. So finally, with some partial integration, we come up with the expression for the action. So the Einstein-Hilbert action is minus c cubed over 64 pi g times the integral d4x. So we put everything together, right? We have, what do we have? We have the expansion in G mu nu. We have the expansion of R mu nu. So we get here, so this one times one, we get terms from here. This one is higher order, we don't get this one. We only get this one if you multiply it with this one. And from the determinant, we get the 1 plus H. So we get additional terms where we have H times this one, for example. Yeah? Gives an H squared, up to H squared. Yeah? Okay. So this gives the d mu H alpha beta, d mu H alpha beta minus d mu H, the trace, plus 2 d mu H mu nu d nu h minus 2 times d mu h mu nu d rho h rho nu, and closing brackets. Okay, so only those terms remain. Okay. So we evaluate the results in Lorentz gauge. D mu h mu nu equals 0. And for h equals 0, after variation. After variation. Yeah, so if we first vary, and then we're looking at the equation of motion, and then we do certain approximations. So during approximations, first in the action, and then do the variation is, of course, not the correct way to do it. So we need to compute, then we have the Lagrangian. What we need to compute is the partial derivative with respect to d mu h alpha beta. D mu h alpha beta, so this gives this term. Yeah, this term comes down. This one here we see, and we first have to do the variation. And we will see what's up. So, so then the partial derivative of L with respect to d mu h alpha theta at the point where d mu h mu nu is equal to 0 and h is equal to 0 turns out to be minus c to the fourth power divided by 32 pi times g d mu h alpha beta. Okay. So also, actually, the spatial average of the Lagrangian is 0. It's somehow always the case that the Lagrangian, if you look at the Lagrangian itself, it's always a 0. Only after varying, you get really some result which is non-vanishing. This again, by integration of parts, you will see this. Write it due to I'm running out of time. So finally, one finds for the energy momentum tensor of gravitational waves. This is c to the fourth power divided by 32 pi g. Spatial average of d mu h alpha beta d nu h alpha beta. And this agrees totally with chapter 1 result. Yeah? So in this classical field theory, we find that basically the same result as in a geometric approach. Yeah, it's just given us the spatial average of this first order derivative is squared, exactly the same expression we had at the beginning of the lecture. Questions? No questions? Yeah, so what we did in this lecture, basically we derived classical field theory, we argued about the boundary term which has to vanish, so we have to introduce a spatial average. Then we expand the Einstein action again in flat space-time, in linearized gravity. We keep terms up to order h squared. Do the variation, then find the energy momentum tensor. It has to be in Lorentz gauge and in for traceless h like this, as we found in a geometric approach. Okay, that was a lengthy calculation. And we see each other then next week.